We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined and very happy to be joined by Jonathan Isaac. He's the author of the new book, Why I Stand, which I was just telling him I finished today. I thought it was excellent. I have so many questions about it. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. So the book starts you could expect with some of your childhood. And you grew up in Hunts Point and then you ended up in Florida. But your life in Hunts Point is really interesting, especially in the context of your life now. So I was wondering if you could tell us just a little bit about your childhood, maybe preview how you write about it in the book for people who haven't had a chance to crack it open yet.
Yeah. What I tried to do with the beginning of the book is obviously just take people back. Because they see who Jonathan Isaac is right now, but they obviously don't know the story of who Jonathan was or how he became who he is. And so just starting it in Bronx, New York of Hunts Point, you know, the thing is my family, my mom, my dad, my four brothers and my sister. My dad is like the spiritual foundation of the family. We're always in church. I kind of give a snapshot of what each child is like and then just take you through it's kind of quick, a synopsis of, you know, going to church and learning about Christ and all these different things and how we ended up getting to Florida in the first place with my parents splitting up.
Right. And actually, one of the things that I found most interesting about your childhood was the sleepovers at McDonald's, I think, which underscore exactly how working class your background is. But you would sleep at the Times Square McDonald's, of all of the McDonald's, the Times Square McDonald's. Well, your dad worked the third shift, right?
Yeah. And that part in time is like, it's kind of funny because we didn't know anything like was wrong as kids. It was just like, yo, we're sleeping at McDonald's. Like what funner childhood could you possibly have? Like we get to, you know, smell the food, see all the people walking in late at night and I get to eat as much as we wanted. And so at the time it was just fun. But now looking back, I'm like, okay, those were obviously hard times. And my dad worked at night shift. So he had to, in order for him to take us to school in the morning, my mom was working all the time. So in order for him to do that, we would have to go with him to work.
So having fallen asleep, as you say, with like the smell of quarter pounders and French fries in the air, what is your favorite McDonald's order?
Honestly, I don't even eat McDonald's anymore. And probably because I ate so much of it as a kid. But I try my best to stay away from the fast food. So I don't get much McDonald's now.
That sounds right. That sounds fair. So you grew up Pentecostal and you write a lot about the, you know, how basically lively the Black Pentecostal church you grew up in was. Tell us a little bit about that and how you think it shaped your faith as you were young. I have a lot of questions actually about how you grew up Christian and even still wanted to, you know, be a part of society, and the book deals with that a lot. But if you could just start by telling us about your faith as a child, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, it was so, the Pentecost church growing up, it's so lively. There's so much going on in every service. As a kid, it's like, it's impossible to focus or, you know, hear anything that's going on because of so much is going on. And it's just a part of the culture of the, you know, the Black Pentecostal church. And, you know, as you grow up and as you're in it, you kind of get more understanding about what is everybody talking about, what is the protocols and everything. But as a kid, it was just craziness. And so sometimes I would fall asleep. Sometimes I would just be there, you know, looking at everybody else doing, you know, what they were doing. But for me, it was just, you know, it was traditional. We went all the time. My dad told us, you know, we had to memorize scriptures and all of these different things, but it wasn't something that I had understanding in. And so I would say it was fairly easy for me once I moved away from Orlando, moved away from Bronx, New York, to kind of venture out and kind of get into everything else.
You had a culture shock when you moved from the Bronx to Florida. Tell us about that experience of going from the Bronx to, I think you were in Naples, right? What was that like?
It was just different. Growing up in New York, I didn't know that any other place existed, let alone, you know, Naples, Florida. And so when I got there, I struggled because I tried really hard to fit in early on with the other kids. And my way of fitting in was horseplay and fighting and roughing around as I was so used to in New York. But it wasn't the way of, you know, elementary school in Naples, Florida. So I got in trouble a lot. I got kicked out of class all the time for trying to be a class clown. So it was just, I was always on my tippy toes of trying to figure out how can I fit in and how can I get these people around me to like me and love me. And ultimately that's what I was searching for, was that love and acceptance of my peers that I had, you know, in New York with my friends and my dad, and we had this close-knit family, and now it was broken. And so I had a lot of questions that I didn't verbalize and was just kind of in my own head all the time about, what am I saying, something that's offending the person next to me? Can I say something to get them to like me? And that started to, you know, put a deep root of anxiety and fear inside of me as I moved around as a kid.
And you write about this a bit in the book, but Naples is obviously one of the wealthiest communities in the country. Was there any sort of racial or class consciousness like that started to settle into your mind? Did you start to see yourself in a different way being in a wealthy white community versus a very working class, predominantly black community? Did any of that strike you? You were very young at the time, but how did that, you know, work its way out in your life?
Yeah, it was definitely easy to see, though. You know, once I got to Naples, and especially getting into high school, you know, you have the kids that are driving their own cars to school and just, you know, have a freedom of being able to do what they want to do it. And my mom was working so often, but we had times of, you know, getting dressed with candles because the lights were out, or, you know, the hot water not on or something like that. So I could definitely sense it, but it wasn't something that I, you know, paid too much attention to.
Right. So now I want to talk about basketball, of course, because you have an interesting sort of path from starting to play basketball and then ending up getting recruited by FSU and ultimately, of course, playing in the NBA. Tell us about your path to becoming not just a high school basketball player, middle school basketball player, but eventually an excellent basketball player.
Well, I played a little bit, not organized basketball, but just at the rec center when I was in New York and with my dad and my brothers, but it was never something that I took seriously. Once I got to Naples, Florida, and I got on my first AAU team, that was the first like, okay, I'm trying to, you know, seek this thing out and play basketball, but I was terrible, of course. I have a story in the book about me getting kicked off my first AAU team without being told. They just let me go because I messed up a game so bad. I started to really fall in love with as I saw what it was affording me. So as I got better and better, you know, these kids that were different than me, that looked different than me, that acted differently than me, started to want to be around me because of the basketball player that I was. And so in middle school and high school, I'm getting little notoriety around town that Jonathan Isaac can play ball. And I have these friends with, you know, AAU groups. And that was my first time being able to sleep over at a friend's house that was white and seeing like the pantry closet with all the food and all that stuff. And I'm like, what is going on here? So it was that was even more of a culture shock. But it was, there was an inviting feeling because, you know, I slept over at these people's houses. I was welcomed. And so it wasn't so much like high school when I was, you know, being, you know, called Ethiopia as my nickname because I was so skinny. So just basketball just kind of took over my identity, and I started to just put everything into it because it was getting me everything that I wanted.
Yeah, and that's a really, I think, critical point. It's interesting that made you work so hard. Obviously, you have an immense amount of natural talent, but you had to put so much into becoming a top-tier basketball player. Do you look back on that time as being, like, with fond memories? Was that, like, a really, in the same way that you sort of describe McDonald's, did you see high school basketball as, like, you really found a family in Florida and you were around other men? You had been separated from your dad at that point. Was there anything to that you sort of got to be around other guys and you had male coaches? You know, was it helping you work through some of those problems?
Yeah, I definitely look back on it and are happy about it. You know, that time was really fun. Like it was the first time that, again, I felt alive. I had friends, which I really struggled with in elementary school and middle school, but I had friends that wanted to see me when we came, when we went to school, when we came home from school, we balled all day long, every day. And my older brother played with me all the time. It was just an exciting time in my life. And I was really happy about it.
Did you follow the NBA closely, when you were like a youth basketball player?
You know, I really didn't. I really liked KD when I was coming up. And so I would watch him before my high school games and my college games, but I wasn't too tuned into the NBA. I would watch the playoffs, but it wasn't something that I kind of binge watched or anything.
Is it because nobody plays defense in the NBA? I'm kidding.
That might be it. I'm not sure.
So let's get into your college career. You end up at FSU, then you end up in the NBA, and you talk about how that transition, you use the word abrupt. So tell us a little bit about your time playing college ball and then how you ended up getting drafted, and what that transition was like.
Yeah, I use the word abrupt because it felt so fast. I feel like from middle school to high school to getting to college, everything was moving so quickly, and my game was there. I could play ball with the best of them, but me maturing as a young man, as an individual, was lacking. I was still really anxious. I still was really insecure about myself and even my abilities as a basketball player, but everyone else around me was saying, "You're so good, you're so good." And so once I got to Florida State, I was big man on campus. Everybody's like, "You're going to be the guy that's going to lead us to the national championship." But again, I'm still struggling with these things in the background. And so I ended up, taking anxiety medication while I'm on campus, while I'm playing, and just having those, interior battles, while I'm trying to play. And so, but that speeds through, and next thing you know, I'm going to be a top 10 pick to the NBA. And I'm like, I cannot do this, but thank God I had Coach Gates there to kind of push me along and get me to commit to it.
Yeah. You write in the book that you were having panic attacks. And it's a very poignant section of the book. When you look back on that, why do you think it was, obviously there was immense stress involved, but with some, retrospect now, with some years in the rearview mirror, what do you think was really, what were you struggling with that caused those panic attacks?
Well, I think basketball for me was a facade of peace. And so because I was so talented at basketball and it was getting me everything that I wanted, I wasn't at a place of, I would say, healing as an individual. I was still struggling with fear, anxiety, and the background of my basketball ability. So when I would play well, everything would be great. When I wouldn't play well, I hated myself and I felt like I was going to lose everything that I had gained through playing well. And so it was always that mindset of working for love, working to try to perform in a way that would have people, want to be around me. And so once I got to Florida State, again, having that weight on my shoulders of you can be the person to, kind of get us out of the NIT and help get us to the national tournament. Again, there was that weight on my shoulders of, okay, if I do this right, everybody's going to love me. But if I don't, everybody's going to hate me and I'm going to hate myself in the process.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotion-y feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths, so you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794 8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. Yeah, that's a perfect segue into what I want to talk about a lot here is you start developing your faith as you get into the NBA. You have a teammate who asks you to go to chapel and that sort of puts your life on a different track. But it's very interesting. There's so much that's interesting about this part of your life in the book. But I love that you talk about your Christian upbringing, you know, growing up in a robust Pentecostal church environment. And then still you had that sense of belonging to the world that pulled you in different directions away from your faith, even though you grew up Christian. So if you could start just by telling us about that invitation to go to chapel and how that changed your life, that would be awesome.
Well, yeah. So getting to the NBA and again, like you said, like wanting to experience everything that the NBA had to offer. I had this picture in my mind of, you know, obviously, you know, not in context of growing up in a Christian household, but I had this picture in my mind of like what a real man was. And that guy had money. He had ladies. He had all this stuff. So I was like, I want to chase that. Still, there's a way to find fulfillment within myself. If I had these things, then everyone around me would like me, would accept me, and I would be able to run in the circle of, you know, the boys that I have. And so getting to the NBA and doing that and having a teammate invite to chapel, I was like, yeah, sure. You know, I'm not against anything that's Christian. I grew up Christian, so I'll go to chapel with you. And the chaplain says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say? It's Luke 6:46 in the Bible. And I start to just kind of do a little, you know, self-inspection, like, man, that sounds like me. But I never knew Jesus to be so confrontational of like, you know, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say, Jonathan? Like, I never kind of got that picture of him. But that it played in my mind all the time. It played in my mind in the games. It played in my mind as I went to sleep. And that's when I kind of had this moment of saying, look, I'm going to find out if this thing is true. I'm going to do my research. I'm going to do all this stuff. I'm going to set on this odyssey of finding out what is real about Christianity. And if not, I'm just going to drop the whole label altogether.
And tell me about that period in your life, because you write that you're staying up late watching videos on theology. You're sort of binging C.S. Lewis. Was this like a thirst almost that you suddenly were struck with and you just couldn't get enough until you figured it all out?
Yeah, it was. I would say it was like, again, I wanted to, because I would call myself a Christian. If somebody asked me, I would say I was a Christian, but now having this verse that says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say? It was like confrontation for me of like, okay, it's either I'm going to really do this Christian thing or I'm just going to drop it all together. And so I was like, I need to figure this thing out. And so I even signed up for a course, an apologetics course on like Biola University. It's like a Christian school, Christian university. And I'm like, I'm staying up late. I'm doing all these things to like, listen to all these different arguments, the Kalam cosmological argument, the moral argument, and all these things about, you know, the existence of God. But I'm still kind of hitting that dead end because it's not, you know, to me, finding Christ is not, it's not a logical thing that you can walk yourself from logic to Christ. I believe that you can get really, really close, but at the end of the day, you need faith, and faith comes as a personal experience. And so I was still hitting my head against the wall, but I was getting closer.
Was there anything you, other than that verse, of course, but was there anything during that time as you were just reading intensely, watching all of these videos, studying theology, was there anything that you found was particularly moving or important to your life?
Moving?
Any books or videos, anything like that?
Oh, yeah, definitely books and videos. It made sense. Mm-hmm. Everything that I was reading, that I was watching, Frank Turek, Ravi Zacharias, all these different guys, when I would hear them, it made sense. And I was like, I know this is true. You know, objective morality and all these different things that they're talking about. I'm like, I know that's true. But again, it's that leap of like, I know it's true. So now I'm going to follow this guy named Jesus. Like, to me, that's a whole different leap. And so, definitely meaningful, definitely all the stuff that I was reading, but it didn't quite get me there.
Tell us about Doc. Obviously, anybody who reads the book will leave knowing a lot about Doc, but he's such an important person in your life. Tell us about him.
Doc is the man. So my first encounter with Doc, and I don't want to give too much away from the story. I want you guys to go get your book. But I meet this guy on an elevator. And this is during this time of like this binge, you know, Christian theology of this confusion in my life. I just got injured as a rookie. So a lot of things are uncertain. This guy stops me on an elevator one day. We lived in the same building and says, I can tell you how to be great. And back in my mind, I'm like, you must not know who I am. Like, I'm just picking the draft. What do you mean? You're going to tell me how to be great? So I can tell you how to be great. And I said, how? Tell me. He said, you have to know Jesus. And I'm like, okay, I have to know Jesus. Yeah, yeah. Okay, goodbye, God. But from that moment on, this is the real story starts of kind of my life being flipped upside down of God just take me on this ordering my footsteps. And I start running into this guy, Doc, all the time. And we end up going to lunch because he says, you know, he's always asking me, let me take you to lunch. And I finally say, look, if I see you one more time, I'll go to lunch with you. So we go to lunch. Finally, I see him. We go to lunch and, we talk, it's cool. It's over. And boom, I'm like, okay, I don't have to mess with this guy anymore. I delete his number from my phone and I don't see him for a while. And then one night I'm at the movies with my old trainer from high school, Key. And we go to watch a Christian film because, again, I'm on this Christian wave. But we go watch a Christian film. The Christian film is absolutely terrible. We leave the Christian film and we go to watch Thor. Thor is like a 3-hour movie. And so we're at the movie theaters for a really long time. And that's important because of what happens next. We leave the movie theater. We're outside in the parking lot. And he's asking me, you know, where are you at with God? And that wasn't weird for him to ask me because all the time of us training, he would always trying to throw little Christian nuggets in at me. With Bible studies and all that stuff. And so I say, look, man, I'm searching. I don't know what I'm doing. I know that I'm reading. I know that I believe that it's true, but I don't know where I'm at. I'm wanting him to reveal himself to me. And he says, look, if you keep seeking, you're going to find him. If you ask, the door will be open to you. Everybody knows that verse. And so if you ask, you'll answer. And so I'm like, okay. So I go to pull out of the movie theater parking lot and I turn on the street and there's another car turning on the same street as me. And our car's kind of hit like just like that. And so I look in his Doc and I'm like, what in the world? And so I roll down my window, he rolls down his, and I say, you and me are going to breakfast tomorrow. And I'm gonna leave it there. I'm not even gonna get too much into, but that is where, you know, again, like my life just turns upside down. And I've really come to a place of finding out that Jesus loves me for me. He doesn't love me for what I can do. He doesn't love me for, you know, if I make a shot, or if I miss a shot. And that was big for me because of how I grew up and the things that I was struggling with behind the scenes. And so from that moment on, the man who stopped me in the elevator, Doc, was actually a pastor and I didn't know it. And so he became my pastor and I started to go to his church, Jump Ministry School, but church that I've been there for like four, going on 5 years now. And I have just grown as a minister, as a young man, and have just seen my life really be transformed by the love of Christ. And so that's how we get here.
So, and you write that you're glad Doc had not told you when you first met that he was a pastor, which has really stood out to me because it gets to where you're, I think, where you were at that point in your life. Why is it that to this day you're glad you didn't know that until later in your relationship?
So that was one detail that I left out. When I was at Florida State and I was struggling with anxiety, there was a trainer there, Amanda. We called her Grandma because she was just so sweet. She had invited me to her church in Tallahassee. So we go to the church and I'm going and things are going well. I like the word. I like the pastor. And then there's a church scandal and the pastor, you know, had slept with a congregant and then everything kind of blows up. It was a wild story, but the church was put on hold and all these different things that the pastor goes away from. And that was all the excuse that I needed. And I was like, look, I am done. I'm done with pastors. I'm done with church. Pastors just want your money, all these different. And so I walked around with that. So even though I was still, you know, reading my Bible from time to time, listening to gospel music, I would never in a million years let a pastor get close to me. And so if Doc had said to me, you know, hey, I'm a pastor early on, I would have been like, absolutely not. And so I wouldn't be where I am today if I found out that he was a pastor early on. So I'm so glad that I did.
So all of those puzzle pieces going together obviously looks a lot like divine intervention. How did that sense of just everything seeming to be so perfectly designed with Doc entering your life and where you are and where he is at that moment, how did that contribute to your sense of, wow, this is really real and I need to commit to it?
Well, that's exactly what it did. It gave me the validation of like, okay, there is someone out there who's thinking about Jonathan Isaac. And I may not be thinking about him, but he loves me. And that's the thing that really set me aback of like, wow, this thing is real. Because again, I'm struggling with all these things in the background. I'm struggling with you know, not liking myself and always trying to work for the love of people. And here you have this God who's like, I love you and I'm coming after you. It wasn't that I was, yes, I was searching for God in a way, but it wasn't that I was doing everything right in my life. I was still going to the club. I was still doing my own thing and God was searching after me. And so there's a verse in the Bible that says, no man can come unless he be drawn. And so in that moment, I feel like God is drawing me, but why is he drawing me? Because he loves me. And that was the thing where the light bulb in my head, or I would say really the light bulb went off in my heart. And I said, this thing is real. Jesus is real. And I want him to be Lord of my life. And that was the moment of, like, again, the start of a whole new story of the league and getting to where we are today.
So there's one of my favorite parts of the book is a very specific example, and people should read the book. We don't have to go through the whole story, but there's a moment where you decide as a rookie to stop fetching condoms, which was one of the sort of rookie duties you ended up with, for one of your teammates. And you write about that conversation, but I was hoping you could talk about it in the context of, like, there are so many small things people, you know, who are raised Christian and maybe generally think about of themselves as Christian do, you know, sort of being in the world and of the world, that are just automatic, and you end up just accepting the ways of the world and going about is the sort of secular lifestyle that so many people in this country have. Why did that moment click for you? Like, this is something where I need to draw a line, and this is like something specific I can do in my life to follow Christ.
Well, after that moment of saying, you know what, Jesus loves me and I believe that he has the perfect plan and destiny for my life, and that's what I want for my life. And so it's almost like what I always tell people today, it's like you getting out of the driver's seat of their life, if you're of life, what I have seen for myself is that I cannot drive myself. I have crashed a million times and hurt other people in the process. So I'm like, God, you know me. Your word says that you have a plan and a destiny for my life. I'm going to get out of the driver's seat and I want you to drive. And so it wasn't about rules. It wasn't about this is the wrong thing to do and you're sinning and all this stuff. Even though I was, the way I thought of it was, I want to please you based on because of who you are in my life. I want to do right by you because you've done right by me. And so I started to examine my life. And again, this, a lot of this is to the leadership of Doc, of going to church, you know, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday and hearing the word and responding in faith and saying, God, I want to change my life. I want to do things your way. So as I started to examine my life, I found different things that I was doing that I know, you know, wouldn't be pleasing to God. And so I unfollowed people on social media and deleted numbers and stopped going places. And one of the early things that I did, I said, was like, I'm going to be celibate and I'm going to commit to it. And it was difficult. But that was one of the things that I kind of crossed off the list right then and there. I'm going to stop going to places that I know are not conducive to my growth as a Christian. And, you know, that was one of the things that I saw in my life that I could fix, but it was really hard for me, again, because of that fear, because of that anxiety, because of having a conversation with a teammate that I knew would be tough. But at the end of the day, my decision to want to do right by Christ trumped, you know, being comfortable, you know, with somebody else.
Well, yeah. And there's another moment in the book where you say, you were hell-bent on experiencing what the NBA life had to offer on and off the court. The picture in my head of a real man was not wearing a suit and sitting in a church service. And this question of how biblically, what biblically looks like a real man versus what our culture says looks like a real man. How did the Bible's teachings on the role of men as leaders and as pillars of strength in their community, how, just in that concept of masculinity, did you find a new sort of way for yourself?
Well, what's funny is Sunday just passed and I was in church on a Sunday in a suit.
A real man.
Right. So I just, well, to the first sentence about being, you know, helping on experience and everything, it wasn't until, and a part of my, you know, 180 was I got to experience everything that I thought I wanted. I got to experience the club and the nightlife and the drinking and the smoking and all these different things. And I said, yo, this is not all that it's cracked up to be. You know, I had many nights where I looked myself in the mirror and was like, what are you doing? Like, this isn't you. And I always felt, even in doing those things, I always felt like I was an outsider. I didn't completely fit in what everybody else was doing. I felt like an outsider. And so, yeah, just as I grew in my understanding of who God was, I changed. You know, I haven't played video games in 2 years. not that anyone who plays video games is wrong, but I have assumed responsibility. And that has taken up a lot of my time. And some of the things that I'm doing now with writing a book, I haven't found a lot of time to do it. And so I've just seen myself change and kind of grow up and mature, and see the world as a place that needs healing and a place that needs change and a place that needs more men to stand up and aim to be honorable, not to the people around them, but to God first, and to that trickle down to their families and their kids. And I believe that's what God ultimately wants.
Something I'm so interested in is whether as you started living out your faith more visibly and in this very high profile situation that you find yourself in as a sort of famous celebrity, somebody who, you know, when you do anything, you have the media spotlight on you. Have you found that being a dedicated Christian, of course, we're all imperfect, we're all fallen, but have you found that has drawn people to you who are curious and are saying, like, even in the NBA, where people are living the NBA lifestyle, as you write about, has it piqued people's interest? And have you had more people than you would have realized kind of coming up to you and saying, hey, what's this all about?
Well, 100%. And what I will say to that is that even though the picture of what the world paints as lovely and fun is really not, and people who are actually living that lifestyle do, you know, look at certain people and say, man, I wish that is the life that I wish that I could live that life. And so I've had plenty of conversations with guys in the league and just people in general saying, like, I respect what you're doing. And I really think it is a respect thing where they see, here's this guy, you know, living to his convictions and all these different things. Like, I respect that. And they may say, that's what I want, but I just don't know how to get there. But they do want to get there, and they do long for. And so I've had plenty of conversations like that.
That's amazing. Have you had conversations like that with people in the public? Have people written to you or come? I mean, I'm sure you get a lot of that stuff, but it just seems to me that the more boldly and the more loudly people in your position are committed to serving Christ, the more people, you know, think that they see that you think it's real and you really believe it's real, and they're interested in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, I do get that all the time, like questions and comments and letters and all that stuff. But the world is hurting. The world really is hurting, and they want an answer. Kids who have found their identity and everything other than the one that created them are hurting, and they're looking for answers and purpose and meaning. And I think that's where, you know, what I've been able to do has been able to shine light on that.
Yeah. So obviously, the condom example again was interesting to me because it seems like it's maybe something where you first experienced that you can push back and stand alone in some cases. And as you write in the book, find peace in it and not be afraid of the pushback, or maybe be afraid of it, but sort of deal with the fear. So if you could start talking to us first about as we're getting to this climax sort of the book, yeah. What was your reaction to the George Floyd video the first time you saw it?
It was horrific. And my I don't even want to say what my first reaction was, to be honest. But what I tried my best to do is to take a step back. What happened to George Floyd was obviously tragic. What's happening to in our world at that time and now is obviously tragic and absolutely tragic. But what I've tried my best to do is to take a step back and say, what is the right way for me to respond as an individual in a way that would create the most change? And so the same way that people who disagreed with me and chose to kneel and wear a Black Lives Matter t-shirt made a decision for themselves about what they felt would create change. But that was that for them. But it wasn't for me. And what I say in the book is that as I looked at my own life, I can't think of a greater message or antidote to the times that we see in our world other than the gospel, other than the love of Jesus Christ that has changed my life. And that's what I decided to stand up and say. But to your point, real quick, when you talked about, you know, having those little moments of standing and finding courage in it, that's really exactly what it was. So the moment of speaking to a teammate, the moment of getting behind the pulpit and preaching for the first time and doing it again, and just having these little these little milestones in my life of being able to trust God, like, and God keep me in the moment of like, so my faith grew, my courage grew, my boldness grew in who God says he is. And I believe him. And so I got to this moment of being in the bubble, and I had the right people around me. I had Doc, I had my wife, Takeda. I had the people that were standing with me, even though I was standing alone, but I knew that God was with me. And so I was okay with being the only one to stand because I believed in the message that I was sharing.
You write about this team meeting where you said, quote, verbal chaos ensued after you say, hey, I'm not kneeling, I'm not wearing that shirt. In that moment, what's going through your head?
Well, I understand that it's an emotional time. You know, these, just the same way that I believe in what I'm standing for, you know, these guys believe in what they're kneeling for. They look out into the world and they see what's happening. And, you know, my sentiment was, look, y'all, like, racism is not the only thing that plagues our society or plagues the hearts of men. There are many things, but to me, the gospel is what changes the hearts of men. And so, again, I was comfortable in my position, but I understood, you know, where they were coming from. So it got heated when we had that team meeting, and I said, look, I'm not going to kneel and I'm not going to wear that t-shirt. You know, verbal chaos did ensue. And guys were upset about it, but, you know, we were able to kind of agree to disagree that, look, I respect your decision to kneel, and I just ask for that same respect in return.
Something interesting to me is that there's a lot of particularly white people in media who attacked you. And in general, it's kind of an interesting dynamic. You're a Black man, and your opinion on the Black Lives Matter moment also obviously comes from that place. What was it like dealing with the media in this political context? I mean, I'm sure you've always had a relationship with the media as a high profile player in the NBA. But it seems to me that it's very different to deal with, you know, regular sports reporters who are covering injuries and the lost games, won games, playoffs, and then dealing with the media in terms of a political conversation. How different was that for you?
Well, first off, I didn't know anything about politics and had been learning about it a little around that time because of how political things had gotten after, you know, George Floyd had passed away, and especially getting into COVID. It was like, if you didn't know about politics, you had to know now, because of, you know, how everything was pushed. And so I wasn't familiar with, you know, politics to a large degree. And so it definitely caught me off guard. I didn't think that what I was making was a political decision, to stand or kneel or wear the t-shirt or not, but that is what they made it to be. And, you know, even with the first question that I got asked after I decided to stand was like, do you even believe that Black Lives Matter? And I'm like, I am Black. Of course I believe that Black Lives Matter. It's what Black Lives Matter had become to be, that, you know, in certain parts I didn't agree with. And so yeah, so it's when things get so political and things get so gray, even more try to make black and white, where if you do this, you're on the right side, and if you do this and you don't do this, you're, you know, an evil person. And so it was definitely tough.
Well, yeah, and this obviously all resurged again when you were one of the few people who decided not to get vaccinated. And you're right, you were pretty sure you had already had COVID, and that was among the reasons that you chose not to get vaccinated. And this unleashed another wave of media fury, really. And how crazy was it for you, just staying on this topic of the media, that, again, you were making a very reasonable decision, one that millions of people around the country had made. And the same thing with BLM. You had an opinion that reflected an opinion millions of reasonable, decent people around the country shared. How frustrating is it to then have one narrative about yourself reflected in the media?
When I say frustrating, it's like, but at the same time, I get it. I understand it. So the night that, and to the point about the whole vaccine thing, like, I honestly felt that the way that I went about it in my mindset, even before the press conference, was reasonable. It was wise. I made it this for myself. But as I saw, you know, the way that people were being treated, you know, religious and medical freedom being denied, people losing their jobs, all these different things, I'm like, yo, something is going on here that's deeper than just, you know, a vaccine and getting an injection. And it really, you know, broke for me when the Rolling Stone article dropped, and I had, you know, an interview with this reporter for the Rolling Stone. And, you know, I gave him the same, you know, sentiments that I shared in the press conference the next day. But when the story dropped, it was completely mischaracterizing, you know, what I feel or my position. And that's
hostile. Yeah.
And that's when the kind of my eyes opened to like, oh man, like this is deeper than, you know, what it is. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, people have agendas, they have what they want to push and what they want to have out. And at the end of the day, they have control of their outlet. They can twist what you say and what you say are direct, whatever they want to the people who they want to get it to. And so I found peace in just standing on my own two feet, standing with the people who I love and that love me, and being okay with sharing my voice and my thoughts on different topics and just standing on it, because they're going to create a narrative one way or the other. But I'm hoping that, you know, people can see through the weeds and kind of just make their own decisions and opinions for themselves.
Has it changed the way that you read and the news and sort of learn about politics yourself, having gone through this?
Oh man, 110%. It's just the truth. Like what was I reading? It was something I don't remember, but just the way that, you know, on all sides of the spectrum, you know, people are able to curate, you know, information the way that they see fit. And I mean, I think it was completely exacerbated with the whole, you know, CDC and vaccine stuff and COVID stuff. I think that really, you know, shined a light to a lot of people that, you know, we don't know a lot of what's going on, you know, other than what people tell us. And so it's definitely opened my eyes a bit about, you know, being cautious about headlines and what you read. And you know, some of the events that I've gone to and shared my same messages of Christ, it's like, people are, you know, upset the fact that I went there. Like, but did you listen to what I had to say? It's like, no, you're guilty by association. So
what did becoming a Christian, did that help you? Because you just mentioned sort of learning more and more about politics, because everyone kind of had to that summer of 2020 when everything was political. Mm-hmm. How did your faith, or did your faith at all, change the way that you kind of understood the country, understood politics, understood the media? I think a lot of the hostility in media is directed towards Christians, for instance, who live their lives, you know, differently than the rest of the world. How did that change the way that you sort of understood the country, if it did?
How did it change the way that I understood the country? I think it was definitely more on like a personal level. The way I think about it is the more that I've grown in understanding the love of God, the more that I've seen that God loves us in spite of our faults, in spite of our shortcomings, in spite of our differences. And that is the love that I want to portray to the next person around me, whether they agree with me or not. And I think that that's how my, you know, Christianity has shaped the way that I see other people. So when there's somebody on the opposite side of the aisle and they're upset and they're shouting about something, like what I try my best to do is stand on what it is that I believe in, but share the truth and love. But I would say definitely, like, and also seeing that it's a bigger battle. I was that, like, it's not a flesh and blood battle of one side versus the other, person to person. There is good and evil. And I do ultimately believe that there's an enemy that is trying to discord and anger and hate, to as many people as possible. But if we could choose to love in the way that God loves us, I do believe that we could change the world.
When you were reading a bunch of C.S. Lewis, did you read Screwtape Letters?
I read a little bit more. I would say more quotes.
Yeah. No, it just, that sounded very C.S. Lewis for you, Jonathan. I have one final question. You've been so generous with your time, and it is just simply how tough it is to be a Christian and also be somebody who lives in such a world of wealth. Actually, I'm, you know, being fairly wealthy yourself, the Bible covers that extensively, but just on a personal level, how tough is it to sort of apply that in our world where money seems to be treated like the pinnacle of human life?
Well, I think what I try my best to do is just walk humbly and try my best to just walk out my Christianity as fully, as truthfully as I know how. But obviously nobody's perfect and everybody makes mistakes in one way or another. But yeah, I know where my church is. I know where my altar is so I can pray. I have people in my life that can keep me accountable and that love me and are not afraid to tell me the truth. And so that helps me just, you know, continue in it and walk wisely. And ultimately I want to become what God has called me to be. So I try my best to get there, each and every day.
Jonathan Isaac, author of the book, Why I Stand. Thank you so much. God bless you, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And just, you know, to everybody listening, I encourage you to head to Amazon, grab the book, here it is. And I'd appreciate your support.
Yeah, it is really a good read. And Jonathan, I think you're having just an incredible impact on the country and the culture. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Of course, of course. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Duszynski, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the...